module here, but I hear somebody giving a summary of what we did last time. So do that same thing, but louder for everybody, because it sounded like a good summary.
I don't know that I can summarize.
That's all right. If it's not right.
We're discussing properly basic beliefs and whether or not they equate with truth, or if it's for the individual, a properly basic belief just has sufficient evidence so that individual has a compelling reason to believe it's true. But there may be defeaters, evidences, logical explanations, other data that challenge the properly basic belief that can prove or disprove it. And as defeaters take their shots at a properly basic belief, you kind of see what's standing after. And Dennis brought up, you know, the idea of if a kamikaze pilot believes his emperor is divine, is that a properly basic belief?
Okay, so to exact, that was good. That was a good summary, despite the reservations expressed. Is a properly basic belief, one of the things that got raised by the way this question was asked was, is a properly basic belief objective or subjective? What do you think?
I mean, it should be objective, right? That's the point of defining properly basic beliefs. But I think it's difficult to always say, right? I mean, we're talking about beliefs, right?
Right.
And one person who may say, oh, that's just definitional. Another person, so even look at, I think, therefore I am.
Right.
Right? I think a lot of people would say that's a properly basic belief. I wonder myself, is that really properly basic in the sense that it's not dependent purely on logic? It seems dependent on my experience that I'm thinking, right? So is that relying on something enough outside of that belief itself that I wouldn't call it properly basic, that it's based on some experience that I have?
Right. And for that reason, he calls out two things that were important, I think, by that one. One is, he alludes basically at the end of that to the absence of an argument necessary to establish a proposition. So a properly basic belief is that something that you believe that you don't have an argument for it. You just believe it. So that's a basic belief. A properly basic belief is one that is like that, and that's the right way for it to be. It's basically what we're saying here. The conundrum is, do we do so solely by our experience, or is it something that should be just, it's an axiom that starts rationally before you even experience the world? I think they end up falling in both categories, but what he said initially that was really important was, you know, we want it to be objective, it kind of ought to be objective, we think, but the fact of it being a belief, since it is a belief, it is, by definition, subjective. So maybe we would say, well then what is, maybe this is what we would like it to be, basic truths. So a basic truth might be something that it's just a brute fact. It's something that is true. That's just the way the world is. Whether we know that or not, so we may believe things. Maybe some of what we believe are true things. Maybe some of what we believe are not true things. And so what we're trying to basically do is say the goal of the whole project of truth seeking, period, is to find out what is actually true. What is actually true? And when I say basic truths, I mean truths that are not, that are as foundational as they get. As an example, you'll hear physicists a lot of times say, this model is a good approximation. What they mean by that is, this model is not the actual truth, but it says things about whatever it's talking about that must be pointing in the right direction, because it lets us be predictive, it's very descriptive, it has great explanatory power, all those kinds of things. But the physicist, if he's being careful or she's being careful, is careful to say, this is an approximation, this law, this thing that we think of as a law, may or may not be right. Or this, in this case, it's the model is not exact. Okay, so we're seeking truths, we form beliefs about what is true, but to Carl's point, they are subjective.
When you say, you said that it is good that these things be true.
If I said that, I didn't mean to say that. What I meant to say was,
it's going back to the ontological argument, right? Where that's why people hate that argument, is because it's like, well, it's better that there'd be a supreme, divinely good being.
And we'll get to that one, and I hope to make it less unpalatable in the long run. But yeah, I can see where, yes, right. okay, if we go, our properly basic beliefs are the things that we hold without argument. And to Dennis's point, if that's the case, and it is subjective, it's a belief, it's the way that we all look at truth. So in the same way that there's this device on top of this tripod, if everybody's looking at it from a different perspective, you may all have different beliefs about what the device is. Now, all of your beliefs at this point are probably, you can say it's properly basic for you to think that it's a camera, or you maybe think it's properly basic for you to think it's a microphone. Why? Maybe Lang told you, who's an audio wizard, a media wizard, he told you, yeah, that's a microphone. Well, you may not have, at that point, you don't have any reason, real reason to doubt Lang. Why? Because he's reliable, he seems roughly truthful, he ought to have the expertise. So it's a proper belief for you, it's properly basic for you to believe this assertion about it. He hasn't made an argument for it. This is a microphone, let me establish to you why it's a microphone. It meets the form factor, let me demonstrate its use as a microphone. Here's what the definition of a microphone is, here's how it complies. He just says it's a microphone and you're rational to take him at his word. Now, then Eric chimes in and says, well, actually it's not just a microphone, it's a microphone and a camera. Well, now you have a defeater for Lang's assertion, for your belief that what Lang said was true, was that Lang either didn't tell you all of it or that Lang was mistaken. So these are how basic beliefs and defeaters work. It's the same as if I say to you, I walk up and meet you for the first time, I say, hi, my name is Bob. You're rational to believe that my name is Bob, because why would somebody just come up and lie about themselves? But if somebody then later tells you, like, that guy lies about his name all the time, his real name's Scott, now you've got a defeater for your properly basic belief. So we run into these properly basic beliefs, not just the ones that are super foundational truths, but ones that are even kind of like superficial in our lives. These are, what's this guy's name? What is this object? Those kinds of things. These are all basic beliefs, which you're rational to believe until you encounter a defeater for it. And so a lot of what we talked about last time was in terms of knowledge about things like truth itself, God, the universe, these kinds of things. We all hold beliefs about them. We all hold, and we hold them epistemically, or we hold them, we have learned them in ways that make them rational for us to believe. Now here's a way for you to have learned something that is not rational for you to still hold the belief. If you have been taught something about God, about truth, about the universe, by somebody you know for a fact to be a liar. Like, they just can't help themselves. 80% of what they say is a lie. And they're like, by the way, God exists. At that point, it's not properly basic for you to say that this is true, that God exists, because you already started with the reason to doubt the information that came in. So I would say that's not a properly basic belief. Properly basic beliefs are ones that subjectively we would say, hey, I'm rational to hold a position until I encounter a defeater for it. Now, the reason that we bother calling this out is... Yes, sir?
You just call me sir.
I call everybody sir. Except for the ladies, then I say ma'am.
So should we... The fact that it's a properly basic belief, should we not equate that with... It's true. It may or may not be true.
It may or may not be true.
Okay, so it's really just a belief held without a reason for doubting it. So yes. What's the difference? If that's true, what's the difference between a naive, ignorant position and a properly basic belief?
It's a good question.
These are... The stuff over here, truths, are about ontology. What are... Oh, no.
It's Romeo Mark and Darrow.
Right.
As opposed to the stuff over at Fisherman's.
Basic truths, things that are true, are about things that are... When we talk about truths, we're talking about things that are or are not. So basic truths are about ontology. Ontology means it's talking about the things that actually exist. Beliefs are epistemology. How do we know what's true? So how we know what's true and what is true, two different things. What we think is true and what's true might be two different things. The project of truth-seeking, of philosophy, of science, of theology, of school, supposedly all of these things, the purpose is to match your belief system with what actually exists. Your belief system with what actually exists. That's called the project. That's the project of discovering truth. Natural truth, metaphysical truth, And put your modifier for truth in there, but the bottom line is truth.
I was going to say, to that point of the difference between ignorance and a properly basic belief, I feel like the distinguishing factor there is effort. Because if you take a properly basic belief and you run it through the ringer over and over again, you compare it against past teachings by people on the same, you're eventually going to come to a place where you're either in strife between what you currently believe and some other position that disagrees. It's kind of like where Aristotle says that's why we study past teachers and preachers and philosophers, is so that we can either affirm their doctrines or we can realize why they're wrong and we can create our own, which is a common thought nowadays. He's just the first guy that said it. And you know, when you have somebody that's ignorant, they just want to stick with what they already know. They don't want to move forward. They want to just accept it because it's easy, versus a properly basic belief or somebody who's wrestling with those is, all right, I want to move forward in this. I want to understand why this is true or why it's not. And if it's not, what do I need to change in order to make it correct?
So is it at time zero, like a new belief comes into my mind at time zero, my ignorance of that and my properly basic belief may be the same thing, but when I go the next step of like starting to challenge it,
yeah,
all of a sudden then my ignorance is starting to go diminish and yeah, my properly basic belief may prove to be held true or not. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many would agree or disagree, but I think when you are entertaining any kind of new belief, you do start at a ground zero of ignorance plus whatever information you've heard from others who have taught on the subject or a seminar, however you came to understand whatever this belief is. And then gradually, as you come into more situations where that belief is tested or that properly basic belief is kind of run through the ringer, then that ignorance does diminish and you know, you eventually continue to hold that belief at a more core level, or it's, you know, it's something that you realize, oh, this was a terrible idea. No, I'm not.
Unless you show up with a presupposition on what the outcome should be anyway.
Exactly.
Well, and one of the things I would think is not just effort, too, because you have people with a properly basic belief that the world was flat for a very long time, and then they have different ways of understanding the world in which increase knowledge, and then all of a sudden you start going, okay, well, yeah, it was properly basic but ignorant to say that the world was flat, and well, apparently now people are still doing it.
Yeah, there's a resurgence in it. It's a little interesting.
It's really great.
Sir?
Well, apparently I'm a good example of what Sir said about somebody coming in and saying, Chris, is it?
Yeah.
How you doing?
Good.
I never heard the term properly basic belief until I got into an exchange with Steve about it. And so I never even heard the term before. So I was at your grounds time zero. And I still don't know what it is from listening to all this. What's an example of a properly basic belief? Just one concrete example.
Here's you. Anybody, us, here you are, and you are, let's just say that you wanted to take everything that you know and burn it down to zero. You don't know anything anymore, right? You know nothing. You've experienced nothing.
That's pretty much me.
All right, you're right. You then walk into this room, and you meet, and you see somebody else there, and you say, I see another person there. Now you have is it properly basic for you to believe that and let's let it be Carl. You see Carl for the first time, as far as you're concerned, ever. One of the first things you're probably going to say is, "Hey, there's a guy." Now what do you mean by guy? Well, guy, that's another mind, maybe something like myself. It appears to be another person. Now of course we're drawing a little bit on knowledge that we already have in order to do so, but you see another person there. It as far as you know. That could be a guy, it could be a human being, it could be an android, it could be a hologram, but the bottom line is, based on just kind of what you know, generally speaking, and what you know, the probability is that that's a guy, not an android, not a hologram. So it's a properly basic belief for you, you're rational to conclude that's another guy. You might be less rational to say, I think it's a guy, but it might be a hologram.
Okay, but doesn't that get up to your absolute truth part?
So now
I don't know that it's a guy.
Exactly, and this is the but you are calling out exactly the point of beliefs. We very much hold beliefs as though these are the truest things that we know. Are they, however, actually true? So let's use another example, the flat world thing. I mean, there you are, you're standing there with your, you've stepped out of your cave with your spear and your bow and arrow and whatever else, and you're looking around and you say, I see the sun do this. It looks like the world's flat. You know, when I walked to a very far point, to a very far point on the world, and I never got to where I was kind of tipping off the edge a little bit, or I never got where I was tilting over a little bit. It seems to me like the world is flat. Am I rational to conclude it's flat? And I think the answer there would be yes. Now, early on, so to speak, in at least a few, several hundred years BC, it was known that by certain people, maybe you would say with greater knowledge, that the Greeks knew that the world was not flat. And maybe people before that did, but ultimately we know they did, because some of the first observations were, you know, this ship's sailing away, and now I can't see its hull anymore, and now I can't see half the mast, and now I can only see the top of the mast, and now I don't see anything. What's the explanation for why that's happening? And somebody said, maybe the Earth's round. And then there were some experiments by geometers where some Greek philosophers actually came up with a really, really close estimate based on geometry of how that the Earth was a sphere and how big it was. That was pretty amazing.
But you remember a year or so ago when I was here that Greg gave you a long argument about how the Earth is flat. Mm.
Now let me. I'm gonna pick on Greg a little bit, because Greg's a kind of a public guy. He doesn't mind. I'm gonna share a debate that he and I have been having yesterday via text. Greg is a flat Earth guy, so in his mind, it's properly basic to believe that there's a flat Earth. Actually, in his mind, it's not it is both properly basic. Like he says, everything I observe seems to me to indicate the Earth is flat. He doesn't make any bones about telling you why he's wed to the flat Earth model. He thinks that if you read Old Testament scripture, that the Earth is very clearly called out as being flat, and so the reason he believes the Earth is flat is actually religious. He thinks that the Bible's right, and the Bible, if the Bible is right, and so the Bible is right in anything it says, the Bible says the Earth is flat, therefore it's right that the Earth is flat. That's basically the deductive chain that he's using. And then he is looking at the evidence, and he says, all the evidence confirms what I think. So that's the way Greg would articulate it, or has articulated it. So I have tried as hard as I can to say, here are some examples of where the flat Earth model doesn't work that you and I can go do. And I proposed an experiment. Let's go down with your telescope, down to the Potomac River. We're going to get on Roosevelt Island. We're going to put it as low as we can get, probably about 3 feet above the water. And there's a lighthouse at Fort Washington. It's 20-something feet tall. It's white. There's a dark background. We'll look through the telescope, and if we can see the lighthouse, and it's, you know, that lighthouse is 10 feet above the sea level or the river level. If we can see the lighthouse, then the Earth is flat. If we can't see the lighthouse, it might be because the Earth is curved, and it's the bulge between them that you can't see. I proposed that experiment 2 years ago. We have yet to execute it. He has proposed some other experiments, but the most interesting thing was yesterday. He would send me all these models of how
yesterday. This is still going on.
I make a commitment to always try to answer questions no matter what. The flat earther one of the flat earther models that are out there is basically this, and I can't draw. I'm just going to draw landmasses. Don't let them represent anything. But here's the Arctic Circle, and here's just portions of land or whatever. And then Antarctica supposedly goes around the entire ring of the world like this one. And that the Earth, this is the Earth, and that the Sun basically does a circuit like this. And in the summer, it gets closer up here, and in the winter, it goes further down here, but that this is the model of how the Sun moves around the Earth, and that it casts a certain circle of light everywhere it goes. So I laid out all the different reasons why this couldn't be the case. And he and I have argued for over a year about the merits of the specific arguments here. This wouldn't be the case. It wouldn't be at this angle. The sun would be bigger here and smaller there. A whole bunch of these things. Yesterday, he sends me something that says, hey, listen to this. And it's a guy with a completely different way of looking at it than this. He doesn't look at it the way that all the other flat earthers say. So the flat earther, like almost all the flat earthers say, this is the way it is. He's got a completely different model. And he says, listen to this hour-long YouTube thing. And I go through the YouTube thing, and all of it is him debunking this using exactly the same evidence that I offered him. And I said to him, and he wants to get in the debate, and I said, hang on, I got a question for you. why did you believe this guy and his evidence, and you didn't believe me when I was saying the exact same things? And he didn't answer. It took me, I had to get more blunt than I like to by literally doing the one sentence thing, like, that's not my question. Please answer the following question. Why did you believe this guy and not me? And at the end of the day, he actually never answered the question. I said, let me tell you why I think it's the case. You believe this guy because he is doing a better job of reinforcing your worldview than any of the other guys have before. You didn't believe me because you know at the end of the day, I'm going to tell you that the earth is spherical, that it's not, or roughly, you know, it's spherical. But you don't want me to lead you down that road, so you're not even willing to listen to me. The point that you should be looking at is we were both making the exact same arguments based on the exact same evidence, and he's credible and I'm not. What does that tell you? What it ought to tell you is you're not open-minded about this to the evidence. That, as you can imagine, did not meet with a terrifically open response, as in any of our cases, we're like that. You know, we don't like to hear that we're biased or whatever else. So my point in all that is saying this: we have to be extraordinarily careful that our presuppositions, our axioms, the things that we want to say, these are the things that we hold most dear, that these things are not getting in the way of us actually discovering what's true. Yes, sir?
So a properly basic belief is not necessarily the absolute truth.
Correct.
Because Carl doesn't necessarily, he didn't have to be a guy. He could have been a hologram.
Right.
So is there any such thing as a properly basic belief that is the absolute truth?
Yes. So yes, there is. I think there would be. Now, maybe somebody wants to get needlessly philosophical, might argue something like, well, we can never really know that's the case. Remember, I said the project, though, was taking how we know things or the things that we do know and trying to match them up to truth. So this is basically down to method. The method, what's our method of discovering truth? Are we going to use only science? Are we going to use science and logic? Are we going to use science, logic, and math? Are we going to use appeal to authority? Are we going to use personal experience only? And then how do we interpret all that? So that's the project of epistemology, and it's maddening. It's maddening when you study it, because the arc of the arc of belief for a philosophy student is all that you know are true. And here you are in your first year of philosophy, second year of philosophy, third year of philosophy, and then your fourth year of philosophy. And you think that you know all these things. And then you take a class in basic epistemology and you say, you take a class in basic epistemology and you're like, well, Scott? I've just been outsmarted by this device.
I guess it's an absolute truth that you don't know what you're doing.
Well, that is certainly the case. I don't think anybody argues with that one. Let me shut it down and open back up again.
I was thinking like Plantinga was saying that based on the analogy of our own minds, that the existence of people that have minds like ours is a common sense view of what would be like a properly basic belief. But understanding that, like, you know, like you said, that it'd be less likely that they're all holograms around us. Yeah, but.
And that's what we're making judgments about it. So, you know, people come into college, freshmen are in college, and they already know it all, and they've proven this because their dad is ignorant compared to them. And then you take this class in epistemology, you start to question it, and then you, in basic logic, and then you take a class in epistemology, and next thing you know, you don't believe that you know zero. You actually end up being like, everything I know is a lie. Everything I know is a lie. It's not possible. And then you get a little bit more knowledge. And basically, by the time that you're done with your major in philosophy, you think that you know a tenth of what you started out doing, because you recognize how hard it is to do what Dennis is asking. How do you know if what you kind of hold on to basically and properly basically is true? So one thing to keep in mind is when we're talking about properly basic beliefs, we're just talking about epistemology. We're just talking about how do I know? Properly basic beliefs are simply this: what is it rational for me to believe about what I already believe? That's the question. What is it rational for me to believe? Because I should have answered it originally this way. This was bad that I didn't do so. Let's forget about growing up. Just think about now. Here is knowledge. This is what, for you, this is what you know. And outside the circle is what you don't know. The first thing, what's the first thing that you should do if you're like, okay, you know what? Today, day one of learning the truth. Today is day one of learning the truth. What's the first thing you do? What do you do, hotshot? Anybody seen Speed? Am I too old for that one? Shoot the hostage. What do you do? What's the first thing you do? Sir?
I mean, you got to keep an open mind and, I guess, meet other people and ask. The biggest thing for me, my experience and the way that I came about to the truth was, for so long I was so deceived and in darkness that I wasn't able to see anything that was in front of me. I got to the point where I was really so conflicted, I basically decided to just let everything go and ask God to show the truth. And ever since, man, it's like one thing after the next, and then the Bible talks about that, once we conform our will to God, He will show us knowledge, He will give us knowledge, and He will direct our thinking.
By the way, Dennis, you haven't met Mo. Mo was in Islam before and has now left Islam and come this way.
So, I think the biggest problem in our world, in our society, is the TV, the commercials, the internet, the things that society tells us from since we're like 2-3 years old and we're seeing, that all gets stored into our brains and our memories, because our brain is really just a hard drive, a storage area, right?
Okay, now you're getting very close to what I'm saying. So what Mo's saying, let me translate it into this diagram. Mo's saying somebody loaded up this hard, it's circular, right? Let it be a hard drive. Somebody loaded up this hard drive with a bunch of data. He's right. The first thing you do is have the right attitude coming to it. Hey, I got a hard drive. What should I be? I ought to be open to truth. Yeah. Okay, so yes. That's point one.
If that's me in that circle,
yeah,
and I'm thinking, well, what do I know?
Yes.
My guess would be, I know I'm alive.
Okay. Now, what are you doing when you start there? So you started from zero, and what he's saying is, what's the central thing that I know? So what do I know so far? What are you in the project of doing, or what is Dennis in the project of doing when he's kind of starting over? He's already got this knowledge set. He didn't turn around and be like, okay, that's what I know. Now let's start going out here. What he did was actually shrink the circle and say, what's the minimum I know? This is the project of basically saying, now let me turn this into a pie graph, even though we've got it differently. Some wedge in here might be true. Some other wedge might be false. Which one of these wedges represents truth and falsity? Is it the small wedge is what's false and the rest
of
it's true?
Right.
Now sometimes we act like, people like this, who act like everything that they know in the circle is true. Hey, I'm 100% on the stuff that's in the circle of knowledge. All right, those people you can ignore. For the rest of us, the right answer is to say, of this whole thing, how much do I know that's actually true? Whether we say it or not, most of us act like or believe that most of what we know is true, and there's a little bit that's somehow wrong, a little bit, but maybe it doesn't really even matter. Is that right, or is it the other way around, or is it 50-50, or who knows? But the bottom line is, point one is take your circle of knowledge and figure out what's true and what's not. Sort it into truth and falsehood.
What's interesting is that somewhere along the way, all of us have been taught that we have to know, and whether this comes from a Christian background or whether this comes from simply a psychological or family upbringing, is that when you bring truth into your spectrum of belief, that the ultimate goal is to have 100% certainty in 100% truth of 100% of what you know.
Yeah.
And in reality, none of us are ever going to get to that place.
Let us be less pessimistic. Leave us in our Pollyanna vision, at least for now, because I'm actually up for that. I'm up for at least the challenge of doing that.
The only thing I was going to say on that point is, one of the definitions of wisdom that I came across this past year that Aristotle talks about, and somebody stop me if you're like, all right, I'm sick of this Aristotle guy, stop talking about him. I studied him this past year, so I got a lot of this stuff in my brain right now. But he said that wisdom in any kind of scientific study is pursuing truth to which the limits of the realm that you're studying in allow.
Yeah.
And the reason that I love that was that it allows the individual to be honest with themselves and others in the limits of whatever arena they're looking at. So if we're looking at properly basic beliefs, and we have one, you know, belief, it allows us to be able to sit with one another and to say, okay, you know, if we're talking about, oh, I don't know, pick the easy one, evolution, and we talk about, okay, here's the possibilities, here's some of the things that neither you nor I, regardless of our background, are going to be able to explain. So can we agree on that, and can we agree on that there's this limit to which we're going to be able to debate and discuss truth, rather than I have the 100% truth case, I'm trying to convince you why you're wrong, and why I'm 100% right, and why you're 100% wrong. It just takes a lot of that pressure out when we're talking about these foundational beliefs.
Yeah, what I would say with regard to that, what I would acknowledge openly is, if you come to a discussion on any topic, pick your topic, philosophical topic, mathematical topic, scientific topic, topic of aesthetics and of truth and beauty, and the other person is saying, this is absolutely true, there's no way it's wrong. Yeah, and you've seen, and you know, I'll go back to the flat earth guy I'm talking to. He makes no bones about saying, I'm not even going to consider the alternative. So you might say, then Scott, why are you bothering discussing with him? Because what I basically am going to say is, there's no point in talking with folks like that, because you're never going to change their mind, and they're not open-minded about it. Over time, I'm just hoping to say, can you see that you're not being open-minded? Because I think everybody says what Mo says here is, if you're going to be honest about it, you have to recognize, and maybe I should have said this first, maybe to your point, have an open mind. Maybe I'll put 1.5 in here. Know or acknowledge limits. And by limits, I mean this. Hopefully nobody thinks that their circle is limitless. You should recognize that there's some small number of facts about the universe and all that there is that you know, and that relative to all truth, here's the circle of all truth, you know, you have that much knowledge, if that. That one little dot. That's it. So if you're not aware of the limits, if you're not aware that there are going to be limits, but this is why point two here, sort truth from false. We know that's part of the project. But what's 2.5? 2.5 is how? How am I going to do that? And the how question of how am I going to look at my circle of knowledge and identify, like Dennis brought one up right here. Here's something. I exist. That is a properly basic belief. You asked for an example of a properly basic belief, you just gave it. The fact that you exist, you're certainly rational to believe that one without argumentation. Nobody needs to argue. You don't have to argue to yourself that you exist.
Maybe I'm a hologram.
Maybe you are, but then would you be self-aware? And if you exist, you would be a hologram at least. So that is something rather than nothing. Okay, so the how question is the whole project of epistemology. So... yes, sir. Sean, and then...
Okay, so this is on topic. It might start off sounding like it isn't, but back in the late 1950s, early 1960s, there was this football team, a franchise expansion team called the Dallas Cowboys, right? So Clint Murchison, who was the owner of the Cowboys up until... that's your real name. Anyway, they built this a stadium called Texas Stadium that was actually in Irving, city limits, right next to Dallas, and it was a domed structure, oblong, okay, shaped like a, you know, to accommodate the football field. And the idea, it had a big hole in the top of it, but they were convinced, that they being the engineers that designed this, were totally convinced that given the position of the sun during the autumn period of time when football was going to be played there, the sun would not actually shine into the stadium at any point. Well, they were wrong. It worked in all of their little models, you know, under this kind of light and whatever, you know, because if you put an obstruction up, it'll block the sun temporarily. But it didn't work in this, you know, in this domed environment. Yet they were so convinced that it was going to work, you know, and there was, you know, gnashing of teeth and all that type of stuff, you know, during all their board meetings. I happen to know this. I wasn't there, but I happen to know this. And ultimately, you know, Murchison signed off on it. Says, okay, well, we'll see how it works. And boom, they knew when they were building it that it wasn't going to work. All right? But they'd already sold the bonds for it and blah, 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 blah. So they finished it. And that was one of the biggest types of things we're talking about in addition to the flat earth syndrome.
Right.
You know, people don't understand the curvature of the earth and that everything is moving, including the sun. Okay, the sun is just not stationary there. It is moving through space anyway.
Right.
I think that's a classic example of...
Now, Dennis gave us a great example of a properly basic belief, I exist. Here's an example of a defeater. You got a team of engineers. They do the math. They say, my engineering equations, the system on which I'm basing it all, and the fact that I'm competent at it. Assuming,
they were top dogs, too.
Assuming it wasn't a calculational error. The bottom line is what they should say is this. I have a belief about the way that all of this, that our model works. Now I build the stadium and the sunlight in autumn comes in and hits part of the stadium. What do they have now? They have a defeater for their belief that the system that they used was 100% accurate. So now they got two options. They can say, the engineering was good. We didn't mess this up. The sun's got it wrong, right? Anybody who's read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, for legal reasons, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has a notice posted at their headquarters that says, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is definitive. Reality is frequently off. So, you know, they want to turn around and say, don't blame us for it. The defeater there, this is where you should, defeaters are going to be something that ought to produce something like cognitive dissonance in the mind of the person who sees it. Okay, so you walk in, you see Carl again. Dennis goes up to shake Carl's hand, and his hand passes right through Carl's hand as he goes to shake it. Now, he's got a defeater for his belief that Carl is a person just like he is a person. Now, he might say, I should consider another hypothesis. And maybe the lead hypothesis now is Carl's a hologram or a ghost or whatever it is your explanation of things that look like they're there, but they're not there.
We have the you have this idea that there's no epistemology with God, right? I mean, if we reduce things down to saying there's a supreme being who's maximally good, etc., then we have this sort of impressive figure who that the entire realm of knowledge is either included in this supreme being's understanding, or that supreme being is that truth, right? So it is kind of a, and then when you start looking at, when we start making arguments for God, you start saying, okay, well, like even the understanding that we can pick up a bit of truth is almost a proof for God, right? That there are real things, ontological things out there that we can take in, and it's sort of an amazing thing about God a presupposition of a maximally supreme being. I mean, even us sitting here understanding and all of us kind of cognitively getting this, even just one portion of a process of how to understand truth, and then to look at a supreme being who is or can understand all of it.
We'll treat this in more depth later, but I think I want to disagree with one of the things you're saying, which is, all of what you're talking about, you were talking about establishing by argument, though. So it is the case that all of those things that you were talking about, things that have to be argued for. And in being argued for, if you're arguing for them, by definition, they're not properly basic beliefs. So I think you're right. I think that when you start asking certain questions, you have to ask, why does my knowledge work? How is it? How do I know it's dependable? All that kind of stuff. And so you're going to want a ground for your epistemology. So this, whatever this process is, so what can, I mean, we got some, we're going to get a little bit into this here, but this isn't the purpose of this class. The hows can be stuff like the scientific method.
That tells you what, not why.
But the bottom line is, scientific method is a way to encounter defeaters, to test your properly basic beliefs. Another one may just be logic. Another one may be math, which is a form of logic, or it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to a mathematician, logic's a form of math. If you talk to a logician, math's a form of logic. There are more, right? And so one of these, though, of how you know, is what we're saying. These are properly basic beliefs. These are things that you start with. So it's Dennis's starting point. It are the axioms. You'll remember last time I said, people tend to get most upset when you poke them in their axioms. It's the axioms. It's the things that, like, although Dennis joked about maybe he's a hologram, I think one would be hard-pressed to convince Dennis that he doesn't exist. I think he's going to hold on to that, just like I would. with great, the defeater for the I don't exist would have to be a really, really good one to drive me off of it. Dennis, I'll bring up something I brought up last time that would be very, very helpful, I think, in this vein. I find this the best example of a properly basic belief. So for those who were here last time, forgive me for the repetition. But imagine it's the case that you were at home last night in your house, and your wife had gone upstairs to bed. You were going to stay up and watch the game for, you know, another hour or whatever. From 10 o'clock at night to 11 o'clock at night, you're in the house. Next thing you know, a week later, the police come to your door and they put you under arrest. So this is you, whoever you are, you in this case. And they take you downtown and they book you on the charge of murder. And your trial comes up. Carl's is your defense. and it's looking grim because they've got your firearm. They've got your fingerprints on it. They've got a video camera of you shooting the victim with your gun, which was left at the scene, with your DNA on it at the time. And there are three witnesses that say, one that says, I watched him walk into the building. Another person says, I saw him shoot the guy. Another person that says, he dropped the gun and ran. I watched him leave the building. And it happened between 10 and 11 o'clock at night last night. Even though and it gets to the jury, and you're looking at this evidence, and man, it's an open and shut case. All of the evidence that is being presented to you says one thing very clearly. You murdered this guy at 10 o'clock on Monday night. But you know you didn't. You know you were watching the game. You were there watching the game at that time, and you don't even know what to say in court. In court, you're like, I don't know what to tell you. I agree with you. All this evidence looks terrible. All I can tell you is I'm begging you. I wasn't there. I wasn't even there. I was in my house. Can anybody verify that? No, my wife had gone up to bed. Very convenient. You know, all that kind of stuff. Are you responsible to follow the evidence in that case? Do you have to listen to the evidence? Well, I know I was in my house. I know I was watching the game. But all this evidence is very, very clear. I guess I have to believe that. No, that's not what we would do. We would go to jail or get killed or whatever, knowing for a fact that we didn't do it and that we were innocent. All of the evidence in the world wouldn't be enough to take us away from that properly basic belief. Now, it may be the case that at some point you start to question it. Hey, was I hallucinating? Did I forget this? I thought I was watching the game, but I freaked out. You know, I had something in my beer and it made me go kill this person. I'm sure you would doubt it, but at the end of the day, I think you'd probably hold that belief. I bring that up just to say there are categories of knowledge that will even be resistant to evidence and compelling evidence. Now, is any of that legitimate is the question. Not does it happen, because there's an example of where it could happen. Is it legitimate to do so? So I just leave that one up there, but that's another example of a properly basic belief. Okay, who else? Who have I ignored? Mo.
Just to get back on that other topic, you guys were talking about the earth and it being flat. The Bible actually does talk about it being a sphere too. It talks about both of them.
This is where you get to the interpretation. So, you know, you got a couple data sets out there. Let's use scripture as an example. You can find, and Dennis has made point of this out on multiple occasions, you can find a scripture verse, and you can find five different positions on it. The joke our two Orthodox friends had when they were in here was, the standard joke about rabbis is, if you want three opinions, put two rabbis in the room, and you get three opinions.
If your perspective is focused on that, that's what you're going to find. But what I was going to say was, you know, the how of it starts with the knowing that you're not everything, really. It's realizing that, you know, there's other information out there that hasn't been brought to you, that has been suppressed from you, that can be accessible as long as you're willing to question, in a sense, is everything that I'm been told true,
right?
And when that starts, and then that brings that light of information towards you, then you have that open-mindedness, being objective, in a sense, and that's when the, you know, that process starts. But I was gonna say, I read a book, I can't remember what the name of the book was, and the guy talks about, you know, life in a sense is a roadmap, you know, and our experiences are, you know, the things that we see every day and do every day. In a sense, we're taught these things, and we continue on this path, right? And instead of taking a right or left, we continue to take the left path because we don't want to let go of of the baggage, in a sense, all these things that we were taught. Instead of challenging ourselves, we're too afraid to let go of everything that we thought, because, you know, then the question comes off, what am I to become?
Right.
You know, and then that's the biggest problem, that fear. You know, but, hey, fear is real. It happens. It doesn't mean that it, in my life, personally, it's gotten me to the point where I was paralyzed, that, you know, I couldn't see it. And
so, but, as always, when Mo talks, I get three or four things that I'm dying to go even more and more on. Let me pick two of the things that Mo talked about that I think are very, very important. One of them is he alluded to the fact that, let's pretend that this circle of knowledge that we're looking at right here represents everything that we know, and that the shaded in area, let's say that, for argument's sake, that that's the stuff that actually turns out in the end to be true, okay? That's what's actually true. There is a sliver of stuff in there, and the question is, how big is it? So this is all false. All this stuff that we know is false. Is it false because people who are talking to us about this knowledge are lying to us? Well, they're lying insofar as they're not telling you what's true, but I don't think that the majority of what we teach and learn and talk about, that people aren't intentionally lying to anybody. Everybody's convinced that what they're talking about is in fact true. So I think there's some small sliver of what we know out there that are lies, where by lies we mean they're known by the person talking to you that it's false. Now, as an example, some of the, like Benny Hinn is an example in my mind of somebody who knows he's lying when he's doing his thing, right? That's a known liar. So now the really weird thing about lies is it may be the case that people are lying about things and it turns out to be true in the long run. But the bottom line is the fact that this guy is talking about that the Holy Spirit is healing this person, that's straight out a lie, right? I imagine that is straight out a lie. It's not what's happening. He has picked these people who are most likely to psychologically blah, 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 blah. So that's a lie. What about this other stuff? This is stuff that we all really actually believe is true. The reason that we bought off on something that's not true is some, maybe our methods were shoddy. Some, maybe we went into it wanting to believe certain things. But at the end of the day, I actually think it's more close to what you say. You keep, Mo said it, you know, you can go right or left, but you keep wanting to go left because you're a NASCAR driver, right? You're good at turning left. You're comfortable at turning left. That's what you do. You turn left. Why would I ever turn right? The track goes left. I know what the track goes left. We're going to do this. So if it is because you're not willing, we are not willing to consider the fact that maybe most of what we know, or some significant portion of what we know, or a quarter of what we know is false. And what if the stuff you care about most lies in the quarter that you're least confident about? That involves the word that he used, fear. He said paralyzing fear. And he's right. Because if you're attacking something that you hold very, very dear, this is your axioms, these may be like your axioms, that you will defend that one to the hilt. That's very important to realize. I've got a second point, but let me get some of the hands first, and then I'll go to another point of his.
I was going to say, to kind of to tie in, we talked about this, I think it was 2 weeks ago, when you follow back a train of beliefs down to the core and how that can kind of unravel a structure, and that causes a lot of cognitive dissonance and problematic integration for a lot of individuals, and rightfully so. When you take a hit at anybody's core values, they're going to tank if they've got a heart. But if you take something like this, you could take this pie chart and you could actually divide each of those sections into levels. If we were to bring an emotional component to this, kind of like what you were just talking about with emotional attachment to certain beliefs, because you could have half of that circle of stuff that we think we know, and we might know it, we might not, and you could shade that, I don't know, however, you know, the frick you'd want to color code it. But, you know, this is, all right, I'm sort of, you know, okay, you got a color thing right there. You know, we make one part of it green, and green is, I've grown up knowing this. This is okay. But if somebody came in and gave you a compelling case, you say, all right, you know, you're right on that one. And then you have another one that's red, where it's just, you know, if somebody wants to argue with you about it, those are the people that you will sit in a coffee shop. Hopefully not, because you're going to disturb everybody else. But, you know, go at it with them for about 3 hours on why they're wrong. And so it just adds a whole different dynamic, or a whole different axis to this whole, almost, you know, the two-dimensional pie chart of right versus wrong. Well, now there's the how attached are you to the right versus wrong, because then the byproduct of that is you could sit in a part of that chart that is objectively wrong and hold that belief, and there's going to be almost a physical force required to get you out of that, which could only come from somebody that maybe you really respect, who's able to kind of walk you through, hey, here's this long train of beliefs that you have that lead back to a properly basic belief, and I'm going to have to be careful, but I have to take you back through showing you how that entire structure is wrong. I mean, and that's a process that happens over time, but that can be incredibly painful, especially for somebody who has held that for years and years and years.
People fight wars.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so if I understand what you're saying, there may be portions of this chart, you know, here's some wedge of what you believe. Some of this part over here, you believe to this depth right here. But this particular belief, look how deeply you believe that one. So people, maybe if you three-dimensional this a little bit, what you're saying is, you know, below some cutoff point here, the depth of your belief hits a certain point, you're just not willing to consider that this part of your belief system right here might be wrong because you've kind of mentally shut it off. And the idea and the one that you go back up to the top here is you got to have an open mind. You got to be willing to look at it because having an open mind in terms of what you're talking about means dropping the bar of what you're not willing to consider down below everything that you know. At least be willing to do it. Now, you don't want to be stuck with an unreasoning skepticism that says, well, I can't know anything at all. This is where properly basic beliefs come in. And the point is this epistemology I'm talking about, the one that has properly basic beliefs as a part, says you don't have to abandon everything you know. You just have to hold everything you know in an open hand. If that's what properly basic beliefs means, it means you don't have to abandon everything you know. Everything you know, you just need to hold in an open hand. That's all. And I think that if we do that, we can say, encouragement. I like that. If we do that, we can say this is we're being honest about the process. Okay, so if you don't feel honest about your own epistemology, don't bother looking for new information. Don't even bother. Don't even bother. Be honest about your epistemology first, then be willing to look at it, and now you'll be comfortable with what you know, I think. And at the end of the day, you're going to end up knowing less than you thought you knew beforehand, but that's okay. The second part of what I want to talk about with Mo is, where does this happen in life? It happens in a lot of different places, culturally dependent. I'll tell you where I think it happens in America, and maybe your experience is different, but for the majority of people, I think this is the case. When you grow up, you know, you start out as a kid, and here's knowledge versus time, and here's where you're, you know, one, and here's where you're five, and here's where you're 15, and here's where you're 20, and here's where you're 30, let's say. We'll just do it to here. When you're one, you know you don't know much. Dad and mom know everything. They're virtual gods walking around telling you what to do. But you're learning a little bit as you go up. And then eventually this happens. Right? At 15, you start to know everything. I started to know everything. Then you get going, and then you hit 20, or let's say this band between 18 and 22 right here. What happens in there? So you have this slow, you know, you can just say that this curve is going up until you're 15 years old. Who's been telling you the stuff that you believe up to that point? Your parents, mostly. By the time you're coming up to, you know, 12 years old or so, all of this knowledge that you've got right here, all this is basically authority-based knowledge. Your parents told you it's true, you believe it's true. But at 12 or 15 or whatever it is, you start to question, you know what? What if my old man doesn't have it right? What if my old lady doesn't know what she's talking about? What if they're crazy? What if they're lying to me? What if about all this other stuff? Okay, so you end up, and this is very interesting, isn't it? Look how steep your curve of self-estimated knowledge goes up when basically you've become the judge of what's right and wrong. You're not being told what's right and wrong anymore. Now you're the judge of it. You think you know a lot more. Now the problem is you hit college, and what happens when you hit college? There's a local dip. Oops. There's a local dip, and what happens is you run into professors. Professors are the next level authority source. They're people who are certified smart guys and gals, and they know about what they're talking about. And so when you're in their classroom talking on their subject, and they tell you that what your parent told you about biology is wrong, told you about philosophy is wrong, told you about English is wrong, you have to listen to them. You're going to listen to them. It's just going to happen. And then you're basically, you're over time, it's going to go up a little bit, and you're going to think that this is your knowledge level. These are two authority bands that are very important. I think that happens. For some reason, we don't ever really make our high school and junior high teachers, we don't really put them in that vein. We never think that they know everything. But college professors somehow, the university professors know everything. Now, when you get into this part right here, your confidence in what they know gets less over time. Because by the time you've got your PhD advisor has been nice enough to tell you, like, hey, man, we don't really know the answer to this one. This is our best model at the time. So they're not saying that what they know is wrong. They're just being very honest about the way they present it. Because when you present it in a freshman class, rarely do you turn around and say, let me lay out for you a model for the atom that we know for a fact is wrong. We just think it's a useful approximation. We're still working on it. But at the end of the day, our discoveries, our lack of discoveries of certain particles at the Large Hadron Collider, that everybody's heard all about the Higgs. You know, this is a great triumph for the Higgs. The problem with LHC was we were supposed to find a whole ton of particles. And we got it all the way up to Higgs energies, and we didn't find the particles. So the big story sounded like we discovered the Higgs boson. This is terrific. The really big story that didn't get reported was we didn't find a bunch of other stuff that we expected to see. Now we suspected we had a problem with our model of particle physics. Now we know we got a problem with our model of particle physics. Still useful. We're going to keep using it. But we know something's broken. But you don't tell a guy in freshman physics that one. You tell him that when he's going for his master's or his PhD. Okay, so why did I call this out? What I want to call out is this. Both of these authorities ought to be treated as authorities within limits, within scope. And you have to figure out what that scope is. And my point is, you do figure it out. But look who you actually trust the most. Isn't this interesting? When you start thinking for yourself, you end up trusting what you have to say really more than anything else. This is my opinion. When you run into an authority figure that you have really, really difficult time arguing with, or it sounds like they may have this kind of ramp up too. But notice what you're doing. You're taking somebody's word for it. You're taking somebody's word for it. And the worst things that happen in this world are when people who know false things are very compelling. Tell me that's not the case with Hitler. Right? So there's an example of, here's a guy with a false belief, but he was very compelling at what he did, and look at all what happens from it. So be careful of authority figures. Be careful of compelling people, because they're more powerful to lead you down other tracks than other
people. You actually took what I was going to say. I think our biggest problem is we put too much dependence on people. You know, we're too trusting, and especially with our government, and I won't even get into that. It's corrupted, right?
Thank you.
But these are the people that were put in a position of power to do our job for us. But once they get in that, they're working for themselves, and there's a big agenda behind it, right? And there's a whole different conversation that we can get into. But at the same time, even in schools, you know, society is taught when you graduate from high school, the next level up is college, you know, and your whole life is boxed in that. If you don't go to college, you're not going to be successful. You know, the money, the prestige, the power, you're not going to get any of that. And then there's other people that after a while, you know, like they're going to school for all these things, but they don't really even use it in real life, you know. But they're wasting that time and effort and energy, and they feel less than because, and I think that's part of the suppression that this government is trying to enforce on us to keep us down, instead of relying on not on ourselves, but on God and seeking on our own knowledge. There's a lot of information. If you're more than willing to look, you can find a lot of information that'll go against everything that you've been taught. And I have a lot of videos that I've been watching lately, and it's insane, man. A book I would highly recommend that started me on this path is called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And that, in a sense, he talks about just watch your thoughts and what you're thinking and your perception. Instead of fighting it or conforming to it, just watch it for what it is, right? And later in turn, the more you do that, the truth will start coming in slowly.
Yeah, people get caught up in stuff pretty quick.
Yeah. So, I mean, our attention gets focused on just what's in front of us, really.
Maybe to that, there's a lot of stuff to go into there, which we don't have time to today, at least in this class. The last thing you said, though, is very, very important, I think, is are we focusing solely on what's in front of us? So what I would say to you is this. In your search for knowledge and doing what you want to do and learning what you want to learn, ask the following question. What is important? What is important? Now, you got to do some discovery to figure out what's important first. But at least you know what's important to you. And then go learn stuff about what's important to you first. And this is why I think everybody ends up interacting with religion one way or another. Because when we're honest and we ask what's important, two things that come out, and I've said this before, are I want to be happy. And I think part of being happy is not being lied to, so I want to know what's true. And, you know, although we can say things like life is tough or I don't like life, you kind of know this is a very dark topic. I apologize for hitting this one. But when people say, I don't think life's worth living, they don't actually believe that unless they kill themselves. So, you know, people who commit suicide at least are, I think, are very much mistaken to do so. And oftentimes it may be even neurochemical that's partially causing that or at least contributing to it. You can say, in some cases, you can say that we all actually believe life is worth living. And so we want to both be happy and we want to live for a very long time. And whether we think it's money or power or influence or whatever else, it's going to make us happy. The question is that going to make us happy? And find that out first. You know, there's no point in going and chasing the American dream if nobody can prove to you that the American dream is in fact going to make you happy. There's no point in chasing being, you know, Tom Brady, who said on 60 Minutes after three Super Bowl wins at that point, he said, I thought, is this it? Is this really all there is? Because it's not satisfying. And you're like, whoa, Mr. Huge Mansion, Ferrari driving, supermodel wife, Marion, three-time football champion, you're not happy with this stuff? And the answer is apparently not. He wasn't. So he went on to win more of them. I guess he's equally unhappy with more than he had beforehand. But to your point, don't let life tell you what to think about. You think about and discover and learn and do what you think is important. In the process of doing so, I think that you'll come to good knowledge. I had another point and I've forgotten it. Who else had something else to talk about? Yes, sir.
Isn't it easier to think about a properly basic belief is one that you're willing to act upon, something that will modify your behavior?
There's a guy, I'll not mention his name. I mentioned him last time. I'll mention him again. I want to be clear that I'm not endorsing this guy, but I find his level of honesty, at least about what he believes, refreshing. He's a Canadian psychiatrist, professor called Jordan Peterson. He's obviously relatively conservative based on his viewpoints. But he basically was the guy who was testified in front of the Canadian Senate. This is what kind of vaulted him to fame recently. On the Canadian Senate was considering writing something in. I was wrong, by the way. It passed the Senate. It hasn't passed. The whole bill hasn't passed. A bill that basically makes it a hate crime to refer to somebody by a pronoun that is not their preferred pronoun. So if it's a transgendered person and they want to be identified as a she and you say he, that's a hate crime and a prosecutable hate crime. And so he was saying, and the, you know, the proponents of the bill say it's only to be used in most extreme of cases as a, you know, whatever, but everybody's saying slippery slope and all that kind of stuff. So at any rate, not everybody, people on the other side are saying slippery slope. Peterson says something with which I agree very much. They asked him, somebody asked him in his class, do you believe in God? Because some of what he's saying makes it sound like he doesn't believe in God. And some of what he's saying, you're like, no, that seems like a patently religious belief. Does this guy believe in God? And he basically, I'm going to paraphrase for him here, but he basically said this, it doesn't matter what I tell you. Or what he said, it doesn't even matter what I think about whether God exists. He says, I act like I believe that God exists. I like that definition because people, for a whole litany of reasons, myself included, will tell you things, and I don't mean to do this, but we'll tell you things for reasons other than we actually think that it's true, or that it's the most true, or that it's the best way to look at it. We will tell you things for a variety, but the one thing we don't lie about is the way that we act. We just don't do it. So I forgot who Lang brought up the point. An excellent point. You want to know what somebody believes, watch what they do, not what they say. I've made this point several times, but I will emphasize it every possible time that it comes up, because that's the true measure of belief. Now, if you really want to see what you believe, I mean, this is the hardest thing to do in the world. Do you really want to see what you believe? Ask a range of people, do the peer eval thing, you know, the 360 eval they're happy about, and ask the right questions, not like, please tell me about Scott's leadership. Please tell me about his management style. Please, who cares? That's workplace stuff that's okay, but it's not great. You want to know what you really want to know? Put that thing out there and ask people diagnostic questions about what you think your beliefs are. Okay, my belief, let's list some of the things that we actually believe about ourselves that we think are foundational. I have a very open mind. I'm interested in pursuing the truth no matter what the cost. I think, you know, I want to be a Christian, and in being a Christian, Scott wants to be a Christian, and so he does the following things. You know, and you go to a Christian definition of like what it looks like to be a Christian, and you list out the top five things that Jesus said, if you're a Christian, this is the stuff that you'll do. And none of us want to do that, do we? Because we all know that we're going to get back something that says something other than this guy is absolutely on fire for what he says he believes. Because it's going to come out that we're a little bit more self-centered, or a lot more self-centered, a lot more focused on stuff that isn't important, stuff that's sitting out in front of us, instead of stuff that we believe is deep. All those kinds of, and that we're not willing to give up our beliefs. If I put that thing out, I can guarantee you some of the people on the list would be like, Scott's really not willing to consider the opinions of others. Guaranteed. That'll make the top five list. And I don't like to hear that, but it's unfortunately true. Yes, and then yes.
I was going to say that reminds me of, I don't know how many people in here are familiar with the Johari window, which is basically split into four sections. And it's a self-awareness technique where in one square you've got the things that you know about you and others know about you. The next one is things that you know about you but others don't know, things that others know but you might not, and then the stuff that nobody knows. And the whole process of asking people to evaluate truth statements about yourself is trying to synergize and align these two spots of things that others know but you don't, and the things that you know and others know. And the more you can get those four sections to have common themes, except for the last one where nobody knows any of that stuff, the dark corner. But the other three, the most you can get those three to align with the same statements, the same truths, the more self-awareness as a whole that you've got. But it does require to have people who know you really well, not just work associates, to evaluate the things that you think are core to who you are.
Good point. If you want to post that to our Facebook page,
sure,
feel free. Yes, sir.
You mentioned, just one final comment, you mentioned we all want to know how can we be most happy.
Yeah.
And we all want to live
forever, basically, yeah.
So I know we're a long way from saying this is true.
Right.
but Psalm 16:11 says, in your presence there's fullness of joy, at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. So, again, assuming this is true, long way from there, this is maximally, this is maximum joy forever.
Yeah, so that, I mean, ultimately, the reason I think people bother being Christians is, at the end of the day, the Christian, in a nutshell, in 10 seconds, the Christian worldview is this: short-term pain, long-term gain. Now, the question, though, and it's a no-brainer if it's true. If it's true that, you know, we can go through, and by the way, I'm a Christian and I'm not miserable. I'm pretty happy. So it doesn't seem that hard to me. But for people who live in the really tough, persecuted, this is hard. It's no brainer to suffer for 50 years if forever you're going to be as maximally happy as possible. The question, though, is that a good bet? It's a great bet. Is it a good deal? It's a great deal. The question is it true? And that's what we're talking about here. So absolutely, that's the whole reason to consider Christianity as a possibility. Of all the options out there, it's the best deal available. So it's nice to know whether it's true or not. But in knowing it's true, you have to be willing to do these things. Okay, last bit. We didn't get to in this class what I actually intended to last time. So remember, I promised you something that's relatively deeply philosophical. I mean, there's a lot of philosophy going on here, but next time we're going to talk about the hardest thing to talk about, which is, if you are going to do this stuff right here, where's the actual foundation that you start? So we said epistemologically you're going to do the properly basic beliefs, but if you're going to do all this stuff that we talked about doing, where do you start? Next time we're going to talk about the starting points. It's hard for people to get their minds around because we just don't think down to this foundational level very frequently, but that's what we'll talk about next time. And then we're only going to do that for one class. If that's not your thing, don't worry. We'll be back up above the waters after that. Thank you for your time and interaction. Thank again today. See you next time.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.